solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
Well, it looks like the Open SSL Security Project is getting some funding. Remember, that's where we had the famous Heartbleed vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
It was an unfunded security module of the internet, and now they're getting some funding. I'll talk about that. NSA has intercepted and bugged some Cisco routers. Everything's buzzing about that. That word came out a couple of weeks ago. And now Google is trying to figure out who gets forgotten. Remember, there was this European court case that forces Google to respond to people who want to have certain things forgotten from their past. It's always a big problem there that we could have. Citizen scientists have proposed to take over an old NASA satellite that's been languishing up there for 30 years, and they actually raised money to do it, and they've established communication with that satellite. That's a very interesting project. And this week, there was an article out that's showing that computer science is really booming. More and more students are getting into the computer science field as IT begins to take off. This week, we're going to feature Robert Lee Easton, the father of the GPS, Global Positioning System. And, of course, it was a huge, huge mailbag.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
But only one thud.
Only one thud. I know, because you know these electrons this week were just a little bit lighter, and I could get more of them fit into the bag. We got a Facebook post from Ken Hutchinson. He was a little upset with something that I said. He said today this was a couple of weeks ago. You talked about the Obama administration revealed the existence of Stuxnet, according to the June 28th, 2013 article. They say that actually it was a retired general defends himself amid leaked reports. This would be General James Haas Cartwright. He says, you should not believe all of the right-wing radio blogs. Well, thanks, Ken, for listening and for getting back to me on that. I don't remember that exact comment, but I did. I know I did comment probably that that this had been revealed during the Obama administration. I went back and checked on this, and I tried to find out whether they really pinned down who leaked it. They actually haven't pinned it down yet. Now, it turned out that James Cartwright was kind of a lone wolf in the Pentagon, and he was always going around his bosses and talking directly to Obama. He was Obama's general, as they say. And he actually had not too many friends in the military because he's always going outside of channels. So I think there's a little bit of politics here as to who's being probed. I tried to find out exactly who did the leak, and I could not find out any definitive information. There was a book that came out that was published about a year ago that was giving some hints, but nothing definitive on that. So I'll keep looking, Ken, and thanks for your email, even though you didn't agree with me. We got an email from Dave. Dear Tech Talk, this is Dave, our buddy, David Byrd.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, it's an email. He wanted, how can I get rid of my Facebook account?
Oh, yeah, okay. We were talking about this last week.
I just want it to disappear. By the way, how do I eliminate my entire online presence? Thanks, Dave. Well, Dave, this is the deal. You've got two choices on Facebook. You can deactivate your account, or you can delete your account. Now, if you deactivate your account, your timeline disappears from your Facebook service immediately. People on Facebook won't be able to search for you, although some information like messages that you sent may still be visible. Facebook also saves your timeline information in case you want it back. Now, to deactivate your account, What you want to do is when you open up Facebook, on the upper right-hand corner, there's like a little triangle there. It used to be a gear, but now it's a little triangle. Click on that. There's a drop-down menu, and then you want to select from the drop-down menu settings. And then under settings, you want to further select security. Once you select security, there are about six or seven security items listed. And the last one listed is a link that says deactivate your account. So you click on that to deactivate your account. Now, when you go to that page, you must already be logged into your account so it knows which page to deactivate it. Now, if you don't think you're ever going to use Facebook again, you can request to have your account permanently deleted. Now, you won't be able to reactivate your account. You won't be able to retrieve anything. So before you do this, you may want to download a copy of all the information from Facebook. And you can also do that by going to that same drop-down menu. And there's you can find a link that allows you to download all the content from your Facebook account. Now, also, not everything is deleted when you delete your account. Like if you've left messages around on other people's on other people's Facebook pages, those might still be there. So what you want to do is before you delete your account, delete everything you can, any messages that you've done, try to unlike everything, anything that you've done in other locations, try to undo it because they actually just might stay up with your name on it. Then after you've deleted all of those external connections that you've made, then you can delete your account. And you can basically, I'll give a link to this thing, but you can, it's basically, it ends in show form equal delete account. And Facebook has made it very difficult to find this.
Yes, they have. I'm looking for it now.
I'll give you the link in the tech talk posting. You can also just Google, how do I delete my Facebook account? And a number of people will give you this link. You won't probably find the link within the Facebook section very easily.
No.
Then once you go to that thing, you'll just simply say, do you want to delete the account? And say, are you sure? Yes, I'm sure. And they'll delete the account. You can do that. Now, if you want to remove all of your online accounts, there's a website called Just Delete Me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's justdelete.me. And that's this. I've got a link to that here. And it lists all of the different social media sites and whether how difficult it is to delete, what you have to do. And you simply click on the name of the social media site, and it takes you directly to the delete page. And it'll tell you which ones that you can delete your profile and which ones that you cannot delete your profile. In the event that you cannot delete the profile... In the event that you cannot delete the profile, what you want to do is how you can actually remove yourself. First of all, you might want to change your username so something that's not recognizable. Then you want to delete all of the content so that essentially your account's just blank. Delete all your content, and if the field requires an entry, just put something nonsensical in it, like Mickey Mouse or Donald Duck, just so you fill it in. More than likely, they're going to require that you have an email address. And I think that if you put in a new email address, they'll force you to verify that email address. So what I would suggest is that you create a throwaway email account. You could go to any one of these sites, and you could create a temporary email account. And then you could use that temporary account, which you would put it in, you would verify the email account, and then after you've deleted the site, just delete the email account.
Mm-hmm.
So that way you've removed all of the information that can trace back to you from that account, even though you cannot delete the account. So it is possible to get rid of everything. And I think more and more people are doing this, and particularly people are getting out of Facebook because after... There's been a lot of research on Facebook, and they discovered that people who are on Facebook, they're unhappier because everybody on Facebook puts this fantastic picture up of them, the perfect picture down in the Caribbean drinking a Mai Tai, and you look at that picture and you say, wow. Look what they're doing,
and I'm home,
you know, sitting here, you know, drinking coffee, and so you start looking at all your friends, and of course, everybody on Facebook wants to make it look like their life is really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a PR thing.
Exactly.
So everybody's looking like they're laughing and having fun, and then you're sitting there.
It's like the world's biggest one-up.
Yeah, and so people, they've discovered that people are sort of more unhappy when they have Facebook. And this started with the news feed. You see, in the old days, you'd get an account, you'd have friends. You wouldn't look at what was on their page unless you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
Now with the news feed, anytime somebody posts something, it just streams right in front of you. So you got to look at all this stuff. So that is a small problem. And then the other problem with Facebook, people keep checking it because of FOMO. FOMO.
What is that?
Fear of missing out.
Ah.
FOMO, F-O-M-O, fear of missing out. So they're always checking those notifications, see what's going on, see what's happening. And so for those two reasons, people are just getting a little tired of Facebook. So I can see, Dave, why you wanted to get rid of it. It was a good email. We got an email from Tung in Ohio. It's the Ohio bunch again.
The Ohio bunch. This could be nothing but trouble.
It's nothing but trouble. I'm sure it is. Dear Tech Talk, I understand that my password can likely be figured out by a computer-driven program using trial and error. Ooh, you know, Tung must have some sort of special thing she wants to keep secret with all of her passwords.
Uh-huh.
What I don't understand is this. Wouldn't a hacker or a person or machine have to try each and every one of these guesses on the sign-in screen of the website they're trying to hack? And don't these websites just lock you out if you have like three or four attempts that are wrong? So how can they really try out thousands of possible passwords? Love the show. I listen to it while gardening. See, not everybody listens to it just sitting in the kitchen.
No.
I listen to it while gardening in my backyard where I grow carrots and cucumbers.
We are particularly multitasker friendly here.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It's a very unusual garden, carrots and cucumbers. Thanks, Tung in Ohio. I don't understand that one.
She likes salad, I would say.
I would say
yes.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what you've described is actually a brute force attack where you can just try thousands of attempts in order to crack the password. But it's rare that such an attack would proceed just by trying to log on to a system. Because you are right, if you try to log on too many times, it will lock the account either for a few minutes or perhaps even a longer period of time. So hackers actually use bots. These are these automated programs to attack these accounts, and they'll try a few passwords until they're locked out, and they'll move to the next account. They just surf the web. There's lists of the most commonly used passwords, and these are the passwords that, you know, really the uninformed might use. For instance, they'll try 123456. That is the number one bad password on the internet. The next one is QWERTY, Q-W-E-R-T-Y, which is just the
across the keyboard.
Right across the keyboard. Sometimes people use "I love you." Sometimes they'll use "password." Anyway, I have I've got a link to the list of the worst 500 passwords that Symantec does. So what these guys do is they figure enough bozos out there that are going to use one of these ridiculous passwords that they just sort of go through these really simple passwords as many times as they can. And it's a robot doing it. It does millions of accounts. And so each day they hit pay dirt a few times, and it's enough to pay for itself.
Sure.
So that's what they do. Now let's talk about the second part of it, how passwords are stored. When you store your password, say at eBay, they create what's called a hash password. It's like a one-way encryption. I've talked about this before, and it can't be undone. So what they do, you put in the password, they convert it to a hash using a particular mathematical algorithm. They store the hash. You can't take the hash and then compute the password backwards again. It's just a one-way encryption. So then whenever you log into that website, they take the password that you enter, they put it to the hash algorithm, and they compare the hash. And if the hashes match, they say you've got the right password. So whenever hackers try to hack into a database like eBay got hacked into, they look for the user account database. And that's a list of user IDs and password hashes. So then they download all these password hashes on their own computers. Then they've got all the time in the world. And what they do, they go through every single possible permutation, and they see whether they can recreate one of the hashes, and then they've got the password. And that's and it turns out now the computers are so fast that it's possible to go through all 8 character combinations of upper, lowercase, numbers, symbols, and everything, go to all 8 character passwords, you know, in a day or so because they've gotten so fast. So now that's why most security experts say you should have 10 or 12 characters in it, because if you've got this hash attack and it's going to take, say, 100 years to do it, then they're probably not going to do it. So that was a very good question. So the hash attack, as I was talking about, is different from just trying to hack your, you know, through the login screen of your account with these easy kind of passwords. Mm-hmm. Well, that was actually a pretty good question.
Yeah, really. Okay. You know, one of these days, you know, I'd love to talk about how these password management websites work, because I think that's kind of interesting. And with all the junk that keeps happening, it's probably more and more important that we all use that. I mean, I have the worst system in the world, and I save everything on my iPad because I can't remember them.
Yeah.
So if somebody rips off my iPad, they've got all my stuff.
They've got every. I hope you don't save it in a file called passwords.txt.
No, I just it's.
No, don't tell me what it is.
You know what? That's a good point. I won't tell you how I do this.
See, but I wouldn't put it in a file called passwords.txt. You know,
that would be bad because then it would tell everybody.
What you could do to make it a little bit more difficult, you could take like a text, like a Word document or a text file, and you could just embed it inside of that. Mm-hmm. So they'd pull up this Word document. And
I have a way of doing it that I think would be really tough.
You'd have to think about it,
it's saved on my device.
Yeah, so and it's not encrypted. Apple does have a way to store the passwords. That key, they've got that password encryption tool where you can store all your passwords with the Apple device in an encrypted way. Hmm. But of course, if they log onto your iPad, all your passwords are there because they think you're the legitimate user.
Exactly.
So if your iPad is physically stolen, that could be a problem.
Yes.
So we'll talk about some of these password encryption techniques, password vaults.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are a number of ways to do it. And the nice thing about the password vault, it allows you to have really complicated passwords, and then you don't have to remember them.
Right.
And it automatically pastes the password in. And then you just have to remember one password, which is the password
to the
vault.
Mm-hmm.
And then it has got all the other ones. So actually, I think that may be a good option, especially when you start going up to 12-character passwords. That may be a pretty good option.
Mm-hmm.
We got an email from Bob in Maryland. Dear Tech Talk, I do love your show, and I listen whenever I can. I recommend it to all my friends as the best technology show to learn about how technology really works. But I do have a couple of small corrections. See, this was like, nice job, but.
Right, exactly.
So I like to feature these. Whenever I'm wrong, I always like to feature it.
Mm-hmm.
Couple of mistakes in this week's Profiles in IT. I think the physics professor from MIT you mentioned was Phil Morris and not Philip Morris. I know because I went to MIT in physics and attended Professor Morrison's lectures. I worked at Bell Labs in Area 11, pure research.
Is that near Area 51?
Yeah. they might have Area 51. I was in 1112, Information Sciences, not 111, which was physics. Now, the guys told me that Unix was created by the research guys, Thompson and Ritchie, as a way to thumb their noses at development, and that Multics was a development project, and that's why it was turned into dog's breakfast. In other words, all messed up. So the people also identified Multics as being more associated with Honeywell. That's what I talked about last week when I was talked about the guy who had invented the password and developed the first time-sharing items. Well, I went back and checked because I always like to get some inside scoop on what's going on back when these things were developed, and I did a little checking. And so I wanted to double check whether that name was correct. So I went back and I found some other source, and I think I did give the correct information. I went back to a book, Creating Computer Government Industry High Technology by Ken Flam, and he said that Professor Philip M. Morris was actually the director of the Center for Machine Computation at MIT, and that's where they had the Whirlwind computer that I talked about last week. So I think that was correct, but I think all your comments on Bell Labs politics is exactly right.
Okay.
Nice email.
Thank you.
Party time! Don't start till I walk in.
Hi, folks. This is David Byrd. Don't start.
He's here. We know what happened.
I'm really
sorry
to interrupt that incredible.
Well, we try to be correct.
I know.
We try to be correct. And we're honest with the listeners.
To watch Jim Russ's face and the knowledge beam coming from your face. The doc was laying this down for us.
I didn't want
to interrupt them because it was.
It was very thick.
I thought we were like a heartbeat away from the galactic space elevator.
No.
That's
that
later.
Down.
If you want to stick around
that's
or maybe
later.
Come back.
You know, Doc, I'm still waiting for a breakthrough in nanotechnology for the space elevator
to be coming along. You're very fleeced out this morning.
Well, thank you. I'm trying to look good. I've been in Annapolis all week.
I bet you have.
Oh, by the way, I flew my drone at the state capitol.
Oh, I bet that went over well.
Not really.
Well, let me.
I bet that went over
okay,
real
this,
well.
Okay, well, yeah. let me.
And so, why did you do that?
Well, we had a
because he's Dr. Church.
We had an innovation offsite. I took some of my innovative folks out to Annapolis.
Right.
15 or 16 of us, and we were all week thinking of wild new ideas.
Did you have the iPhone in the? On the drone?
He's getting to it.
No, I had the iPhone, and I was holding the iPhone, and I was looking at pictures.
Right.
Now, my drone sets up its own personal Wi-Fi hotspot, and then I connect my iPhone to the drone hotspot, and I've got a Wi-Fi extender so I can connect to my drone when it's 1,000 feet away by Wi-Fi.
I need a wet towel here. I'm going to wipe my face off.
So
it's pretty deep.
Here's the thing. Okay. When you're at the state capitol, they do not like rogue Wi-Fi hotspots.
No, they don't.
Because that's how you could put in like some secret camera looking around.
Yeah.
So I got my drone all set up. I launched it.
How many state police surrounded you?
No, they jammed my Wi-Fi hotspot, and all the video just blanked out.
Did the drone go away? Did you hurt your drone?
No, the drone was perfect.
All right.
But it took them about 2 minutes. You know, it was working perfectly. I was going to take a group picture of the team with the state capitol in the background, beautiful scenery, and I was getting all set up for the picture. Bingo. They blocked my rogue Wi-Fi hotspot there at the state capitol. Now, the good news is my drone was not confiscated.
Excellent.
And
you
I was not arrested.
Yes. And the drone was not damaged.
In which order that happened.
Exactly.
Drone not confiscated, him not arrested.
That's why he's a PhD.
And when I got back to the hotel, it was all working perfectly.
Very nicely done, Doc.
So there you go. I would not recommend flying your drone around the Maryland State Capitol.
Or government facility, because have you ever noticed you've gone down Wisconsin, you can't make a phone call on your cell phone in front of the Bethesda Naval
On the other hand, this the
you can't get phone service in front of whatever they call it now. I used to call it Bethesda Naval.
You used to be Navy Med.
On the other hand, the police station next door, I can fly the drone over by them.
They don't do anything
to my Wi-Fi hotspot.
They don't care as long as you don't vandalize their cars with it.
That's all. They're watching for that.
Can we change the page just real quickly?
I'm on a tight leash. You're on a tight leash.
I'm on a very tight leash.
Okay.
I am really shocked, not shocked, and kind of dismayed that I have not heard more talk about the facial recognition software and what's happening with that and how that can violate privacy after a while.
Yeah, that is.
They keep a huge database. In other words, hey, there's Dr. Schertz. He's in a Radio Shack again because our facial recognition, it just boomed. It locked onto you and took your whole database away.
This facial recognition software has gotten extremely, extremely good.
Real good.
It's got real good. I put all my pictures in Pandora, and I store all my pictures. You say to yourself, you know, I'd like the picture of so-and-so and so-and-so. It does face recognition and groups all my pictures according to who's in them.
Really?
Automatically.
No kidding.
It scans through all
That's
the photos
scary.
And does face recognition. So I could put somebody's name. I mean, you have to tell
it. You can make up your own photo. Like, I'd like to have my photo with Jim and Dave. So let's take those photos from wherever and put them together.
Well, no, it doesn't do that.
No.
Okay. It doesn't do that. And so the thing with this face recognition software, because
they can track you everywhere. That's the
especially
key.
With the surveillance cameras.
Yes.
You can do that very, very neatly.
Now, if we were in London right now, where I think every square inch of London's under video surveillance, mm-hmm. really, yes. I'm not making a joke.
No, yes. really, seriously.
They can track your entire movements with facial recognition.
That's right. And so now what they've done, in especially, they're using this in UK, people are putting, are wearing things like glasses.
Hats.
And hats to sort of break up the facial recognition ability.
Right.
Because it's using like the distance between your eyes and, right. and your facial geometry. And so now people are actually actively trying to keep that from happening. We haven't reached that point in the U.S. We don't have surveillance everywhere like they do in the U.K.
I think they're going to get that way in D.C.
But it's getting, it is, it's getting. And the other, the other thing that's particularly dangerous on the web is that, you know, people put snaps of you all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
So here's the thing. So with facial recognition software, I could surf the web and I could pull up every picture that you're in, no matter where it is.
Oh, man.
Think about that. Think about that.
Wow. That's scary.
Yeah. And so I think this facial recognition software on the web is really powerful and dangerous.
Do you see any regulations for facial recognition software?
I don't
think so.
And
how it's used and et cetera? Isn't it a violation of privacy if they keep a database on everybody?
I don't.
No?
No, I don't. I don't think they're going to regulate that.
Really?
I don't think they're going to regulate that.
But don't bad guys always wear a ski mask? So how good
is
this?
That's what I thought. Uh-huh. You know, with the sunglasses.
Right.
Yeah, but the thing is, they
and
can
an Indiana Pacers baseball hat over top of that.
Here's the thing. Once there's this broad database with facial recognition, they can punch in your, you know, your facial characteristics, and they can track you. I mean, maybe you're in the UK,
stores,
maybe you're
streets.
Here. They could start pulling all of that data together from these surveillance cameras
and tell you everything you did that day.
And they could track you down. Yeah.
And they could probably predict where you're going to go based on what you do every day, right?
They could do that.
Pretty close.
Now actually,
but you're at Bob Evans every morning, right?
But here's the thing.
I get two of those Grand Slam breakfasts. Man, that's good stuff.
Okay. But we're already. Do you carry your cell phone with you?
Well, absolutely.
It's got GPS on it.
But I don't allow anything. When they say that, do you want people to know where you are? No, I don't.
Apple keeps all your GPS. They know where you've been.
Oh, yeah, of course they
do. It's stored.
Yeah. Wow.
Don't tell me the check didn't clear. We know what's going on.
It's stored. And so actually, you're walking around with the GPS tracker. And so the question is, how long does that data stay there?
For a long time.
Well,
anybody who reads any spy novels know the first thing you throw away is your phone.
Exactly. After the gun. Right.
I suppose you could turn off GPS, except it's so convenient to have it on.
I don't trust anything on this phone. I'd throw the whole phone away and buy me one of those temporary throwaway phones.
Get yourself a burner.
Very nicely done. You're Robert Ludlum.
I was watching The Wire last night.
Okay.
Smoke signal.
There we go.
So you could go to smokes. You know, actually, I don't know if you can even trust, you know, phones.
Because, I don't trust anything.
Because they also have voice recognition software, Dave.
That's scary.
So, you know, so.
Very scary.
So I'm thinking you should just, you know, do what Osama bin Laden does.
Yeah.
No couriers. Cell phone.
Couriers
you need. You need to live in a cave.
Right.
And have your relatives pass messages.
But it still didn't even work for him.
No, it didn't work out that well.
No, it didn't.
It's because his best boy had a cell phone.
No, he kept showing up at Denny's and they tracked him from there. You know, mm-hmm. I love Denny's.
That's actually what happens.
Doc, I got to leave in a couple of seconds. Anything exciting that you can just announce right now? Something you've discovered?
Anything exciting?
Exciting. Everything's exciting.
David, this whole show is 60 minutes of excitement.
You got rocking my world here?
The entire.
Right.
Well, you did hear about NSA intercepting all the Cisco routers.
Of course.
You heard that stuff. Oh, Flappy Birds is going to be on the app. Flappy Birds is back. It's coming back to the app store.
Oh, God help me.
Will we have an in-depth discussion? Oh.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. And, of course, we have Google is trying to find out how to forget people.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to be forgotten. We talked about that last week. I want to be forgotten.
You want to be forgotten.
Are we going to do an I Hid the Cash field trip?
Well, you know,
what a waste of time that is.
God, I can't believe all these people rushing to the scene trying to look for $150,
with
right?
All the crap that's going on in this world, the media spends all this time on that.
I know. It's called free cash. That's what you ought to do. I think Stratford needs to do that.
That's it.
A Stratford envelope hide the cash. Will be somewhere in this area. There's 18 of these envelopes from Stratford University.
And give out free cash.
Free education.
Oh, yeah.
One year.
I say free meal tickets to the Escoffier at Stratford University.
Thank you.
You know, this week I painted a picture, Dave.
You did?
Yeah.
When are we going to see it?
Well, it's we had an innovation offsite, and part of this thing to get people thinking in an innovative way.
Right.
Everybody there had to paint an acrylic painting.
Acrylic.
So we were like painting. I mean, no, mine looks like kind of a Picasso sort of abstraction. Wow. It's not anything that you could recognize.
You did that one ear version of Dr. Scherr.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. It was sort of the Picasso look, because I can't draw anything that looks real.
That's true. That's true.
Although,
because you're always thinking 3D.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I can't keep up with them.
Well, when are you going to get a 3D printer upstairs? Are they going to get 3D printers upstairs?
They're afraid we'll make weapons out of it. Or something.
Yeah,
I'm not surprised.
I'm not surprised either.
Yeah,
Doc, I have to leave.
Okay,
it's
David, thanks.
Hey,
nice to see you.
Bye, Jimbo. I love you, man.
Okay. Hey, by the way, epaulets. Epaulets, love them. Nice.
Love the epaulets.
Very nice.
Yeah, that's the latest.
Where did you park the Allier?
I got this from the A-Team wardrobe. Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
All right, have a good one. Thank you for listening this morning. This is Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. We will be back shortly here on Tech Talk Radio.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Master's in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to feature Roger E. Lee Easton, Sr. That's what his wife called
Senior.
Him. Senior. That's what his wife called him. His mother called him Roger E. Easton. She didn't worry about the senior business. He is father of GPS and a pioneer in modern-day navigation. Roger was born April 30th, 1921, in Craftsbury, Vermont. He graduated from Middlebury College in 1943 and began working at the Naval Research Lab, NRL, that same year.
That's here in D.C., right?
Yeah, it's local. He actually worked there his whole career.
Huh.
He was assigned to work in the radio division on radar beacons and blind landing systems. He also worked in the Rocket Sunday branch on space-related research. In 1955, he had part in writing a proposal for the Vanguard Project, which was a satellite program for the International Geophysical Year. You know, the Navy wrote a proposal, Army wrote a proposal, and the services all wrote proposals. And then the Eisenhower administration had to pick one, and they picked, they liked Project Vanguard, and they decided to fund it. Easton also, as once the project got started, he also was part of the design team on the satellite itself. In 1957, he went on to design a system called Mini-Track. Now, Mini-Track tracked various Earth-orbiting objects. So the idea was we had all these satellites in space. How can we track them to keep them? Because we don't want them to hit each other. So we want to keep track of what's going on in outer space. And so he had Mini-Track, which was designed to track satellites that were orbiting the Earth. When Sputnik 1 was launched, Easton extended the system to actively follow unknown orbiting satellites. Because now we had to worry about what the Soviets were up to. In 1959... he designed the Naval Space Surveillance System, Nav Spa Sir.
That's easy to remember.
I'm thinking Naval Space Surveillance System. I don't know. That acronym is just...
I think
they should have really... Probably
they need to tighten that up a little bit.
They really do. They need it. They need to really focus on their acronyms a bit. Mm-hmm. The Naval Space Surveillance System became the first system to detect and track all types of Earth orbiting objects. And it goes through the 33rd parallel, which is basically coast to coast. So it basically is passing over the United States. Now, later in his career, he got the idea, and he patented this idea that led to, he said, look, if we can sit on Earth and calculate where the satellites are located, would it be possible for us to use satellites, if we knew where they were located, to calculate a position on Earth?
Mm-hmm.
Go the other way.
Sure.
So he came up with this idea because the math, you know, seemed to work out okay. And so he patented the idea for a global positioning system. Now, he didn't call it that then, but that's what we call it now, GPS. And he started developing the technology that would enable us. But he ran into an issue. The tracking stations weren't synchronized. The time on the tracking stations weren't synchronized. And so that led to problems because we didn't know, you know, exactly what time it was. You need time synchrony for this all to work. So he had the idea of putting highly accurate clocks on multiple satellites. And then they would be able to determine the precise location of someone on the ground. So let's say if you want to locate a position on the ground, you've really got three coordinates, X, Y, and Z. And if you have a precise clock on your system that's synchronized with the clocks in the satellite, you could then get your precise location if you had the time with only three satellites. But it turns out that our GPS systems don't have a precise clock on them. So we actually have to derive time information. So we have four variables. We have to get time plus X, Y, and Z. So it takes a minimum of four satellites to get GPS data.
So this is where the whole notion of triangulation came from, right?
Yeah, it's triangulation, and then you add time because you're looking at phase shift, so you also have to have the time.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to get time plus three positions, you got four equations, four variables. So you need four satellites. Since it's all about me, I'm talking about my drone. Before my drone will take off, it has to lock onto six satellites.
Really?
Because you can actually see up to 11. You know, the satellites are in near Earth orbit. Sometimes, depending on where you're at, you can see up to 11 satellites. But you only need four to get the absolute number.
Mm-hmm.
So, but my drone won't take off until I have six satellites because it's thinking, okay, maybe I'll lose a couple. And you don't want to lose GPS when you're in mid-flight because you might fly off somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get back to the story.
Yeah, it's
not all about me. During the 60s and 70s, he developed a time-based navigation system with passive ranging, circular orbits, and space-borne high-precision clocks. Initially, he called it Timation.
Timation.
Timation. That stands for time navigation. This is just... Timation. They really need to get a better naming guy there at NRL.
I don't know.
So time navigation, he shortened to Timation. So this was this big push. So the idea was tested on four experimental satellites. Okay, the first two satellites, Timation 1, Timation 2. In 1967, 1969. Then they had two more. I think people got fed up with that name. And the next two were called Navigation Technology Satellites, NTS.
See, you science guys don't come up with good names. You need a marketer, like a Globe Monster or something like that.
Well, like Bill Gates sort of teamed up with Wozniak.
Mm-hmm.
So Wozniak was kind of the techie, and then Bill Gates came up with, hey, let's call it Windows. You know.
Hello.
Yeah, that's right. And so they launched Navigation Technology Satellites, NTS-1 and NTS-2, in 74 and 77. NTS-2 was the first satellite to transmit GPS signals. So that was the first really major GPS system. That was in 1977. That was getting to be, you know, fully deployed. Eventually, but you see, as in all government things, everybody's competing.
Right.
So it turned out, you know, because, you know, NRL had their deal and then other agencies had their deal. And finally, the Department of Defense had to bring all these guys together who were all trying to get variations of GPS working together. And they took many of the features from the Navy navigation system and they renamed it Global Positioning System in the early 1970s. Global Positioning System, GPS. Now, that's the name that we have now. Easton is viewed as the father of GPS because many of the foundation patents and the initial thinking was done by him, even mm-hmm. though other services began to sort of pick up the ball and run with it. Easton retired in 1980. In 1986, he ran for governor. And then he wasn't elected, though. He served three terms on the board of the New Hampshire Electric Cooperative. I guess he was kind of interested in, you know, civics after that. Easton died May 8th of 2014 at age 93. That's why I'm featuring him, because he actually died this month. Mm-hmm. George W. Bush awarded Easton the National Medal of Technology, which is the highest civilian technology medal you can get. He was awarded this for his pioneering achievements in spacecraft tracking, navigation, and timing technology that led to the development of the Navistar GPS. He received that National Medal of Technology in 2006. So there you go. Roger Lee Easton, a man who worked at NRL, who is the father of GPS.
See, Navistar is a catchy name. That's cool. GPS, I mean, that doesn't work. How about Location King or something? It's got something
catchy.
Yeah,
Location King. I could be good. Like, yeah, that's right. That's right.
Well, we hope you were paying to our nonsense here, because this knowledge could actually land you a free lunch. Hang on. The Tech Talk Pop Quiz is coming up next on Tech Talk Radio. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. We'll be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn by doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University, changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now, here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Welcome back to Classroom of the Airwaves.
You almost tripped up there.
I almost did. Mm-hmm. It's also Classroom of the Internet, too, because we stream this show live.
Yes.
Around the entire world. Mm-hmm. If you get the correct answer to the pop quiz, which, of course, we're using to assess your knowledge, you win two tickets to fine dining at the Escoffier Dining Room or at the Krim Dining Room. One is in Falls Church. One is in Woodbridge. We'll surely be opening other dining rooms as we're adding more and more campuses. Oh, yeah. They'll be coming along. Earlier in the show, I was talking about Roger Lee Easton, the father of GPS. Now, the first navigation system, which he developed while he was at Naval Research Labs, had a particular unusual name. It wasn't GPS. It was something else.
Right.
Which was a combination of two words put together.
Mm-hmm.
What was that particular name that he used for that navigation system. If you get the correct answer, you win 2 tickets to Fine Dine at the Escoffier Dining Room. Now, how can they reach us, Jim?
Well, you have the correct answer. You need to call us on that right now. Calling from west of Craftsbury, Vermont, it's 877-936-9333. From east of the Naval Research Lab, it's 877-936-9333. For those calling from anywhere else on the planet using your GPS-enabled device, it's 877-936-9333.
If you're calling from Mongolia, where we just had one of our... We just had a team of folks there at Mongolia talking to some future students. You can reach us on Skype. Simply contact us through by connecting to Tech Talk Radio 1. You'll be forwarded directly to the studio free of charge. Well, let's just cover a few topics while we are sitting here waiting. Have you heard about the iMessage problem that Apple is having?
I have not.
Of course, you know what the iMessage is. It's a convenient way for iPhones to connect. And what you do, you send what looks like a text message to another iPhone. The Apple system will intercept it because all of the iPhone phone numbers are registered. So it says, okay, don't send this as a text message. It intercepts it, sends it through the iCloud as an iMessage to another iPhone. And so you just use data. You don't use part of your text message allotment. And the advantage of that is that you can send photos. I've sent huge files as attachments to iMessages to other iPhones, which would be too big to email. So it's a very convenient system. But there is a problem.
What is that?
The problem is, and Apple's been sued over this, suppose that you leave the fold. You leave the comfort of the Apple ecosystem.
The nurturing environment that is.
And you go over to Android, or one of those in the enemy camp.
Dun, 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 dun.
And then you transfer your phone number from the iPhone to the Android. Okay, should be no problem. Apple just says, okay, we're going to miss you, and we're going to, make certain that you, we'll miss you and enjoy the Android.
When you come back.
But what happens is your phone number is still registered with the iMessage.
Mm-hmm.
So all your friends who have iPhones, when they try to send you a text message, Apple still thinks it's an iPhone phone number.
No.
And so your text message goes to the iCloud servers waiting to be delivered to an iPhone that now no longer exists.
It's like text message purgatory. It just sits there.
Mm-hmm. So some woman, she all of her friends have iPhones, and then she went to the Android camp, and all of a sudden she wasn't getting any invitations to dinner. Nobody was contacting her. Then people were saying, "What's up with you? You don't answer our text. You don't answer our iMessages." And so she was really upset because she felt she was losing a lot of business, maybe some social connections.
Sure.
So she filed a class action lawsuit against Apple. So here is what you need to do. Apple has said they're going to fix it. They said, okay, we're going to fix this, guys.
Was this intentional?
No, I don't think it was.
Okay.
I don't think it was intentional. So Apple released this statement on their blog, on their Recode blog. They said, we recently fixed a server-side iMessage bug, which was causing an issue for some users. We have an additional bug fix in a future software update. Apple told Recode in a statement, for users still experiencing an issue, please contact Apple Care.
Okay.
So it's not guaranteed to be fixed, but they're saying they could fix it. So this is my advice to you. If you are going to leave the fold, you want to disable iCloud and iMessage.
Mm-hmm.
So what you want to do on your phone, you want to take the iMessage, disable it. You want to unregister your name. If you've got if you've registered that phone number with multiple devices, like you've got iPads and other things, remove that from any kind of iMessage synchronization everywhere and totally take yourself out of the iMessage ecosystem.
You need to wring yourself from the cloud.
Right. And do that before you disable the phone.
Gotcha.
And then you won't have this problem.
Okay.
Yes.
We have a victim. Contestant
okay,
on the phone.
Okay, very
Let
good.
Let us go to Carl, who's calling from nearby Silver Spring, Maryland. Carl, good morning. How are you, sir?
Good morning. Enjoy your show.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Earlier today, we talked about Roger E. Eastern, father of GPS and pioneer of modern-day navigation. What was the name of the navigation system that he first launched while he was at NRL?
Well, he took the word time and navigation and came up with Timation.
Correct. Very good. Two tickets to Fine Dining at the Escoffier Dining Room or the Karim Dining Room. Stay on the line and we'll get your name and number.
Carl, thank you very much for calling. Stand by. You are listening to Tech Talk Radio. This is Federal News Radio on 1500 AM, 820 AM and 107.7 FM HD2. We will be back with more of Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Masters in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. You know, I'd like to talk a little bit about this innovation workshop that we had there out at Annapolis.
Mm-hmm.
We got 15 or 20 of our innovative academic folks out there, and we just wanted to kind of reinvent education. And there's something that I wanted to talk about what does it take to make education engaging. Mm-hmm. And we all know that there are just sometimes you just go to a lecture and it's just boring. It's boring. And so how can an institution engage students in the way that they learn? So we were one of the principles that we use, it's based on some research that Daniel Pink did, and he was talking about intrinsic motivation. And you know, I outlined this in a book, Drive, which is really very good, and businesses have used this. And he said there are three elements that you need for intrinsic motivation. And if you have intrinsic motivation, it means you're engaged, you want to do something. Not because you're paid for it, but because you just want to do it. You're not doing it for the grade. You're doing it because you enjoy doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So the three things you need are autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Now, autonomy means that you're able to kind of pick on at the moment what you're interested in. If something's really engaging or really hot that you really want to do it, you've got time to work on it. You can pick the technique you use. You can assemble your own team to work on it. You can select when you want to do it. So if you've got time, technique, team, and task, you can, those four T's, you have autonomy. And so you have to structure the academic program so the students have kind of a choice on how they work. That's why we go to, say, project-based work, where they pick projects. Then you have to have, the second thing is mastery. Now, whenever some people are working, whenever anyone's working on a task, they always try to master what they're doing. And mastery is kind of an asymptotic curve. You approach it gradually. Suppose you're not a master yet. You're just sort of learning. There's probably a task for you that's not too difficult and not too easy. If it's too easy, it's boring. If it's too difficult, you give up. So a task which is not too easy and not too difficult, which is just right, is called the Goldilocks task. You know, the porridge is not too hot and not too cold. It's just right. So you need a series of Goldilocks tasks in order to do this, and then you can work toward mastery. And the third thing, you need to understand the big picture. Why are you working on it? This is the purpose. And so if you can create a learning environment with autonomy, mastery, and purpose, you're able to do that. Now, Marie Montessori invented this back in the, back in the early 1900s in Rome. And she, so Montessori schools have used this. They have, like, the prepared classroom, and kids can pick their project. They have engaging tasks. And kids basically teach themselves. But it's a structured environment that has Goldilocks tasks, that has the big picture, and it has autonomy and teamwork. So we're trying to actually weave all of these things together in making a very engaging atmosphere at Stratford, which means we're turning everything into more project-based work and focused on competencies. And we're trying as best we can to minimize the lecture, because the lecture is probably the least engaging part of any learning experience, and that what you figure out on your own by experimentation, you remember for a lifetime. And so it was actually quite a lot of fun to do this offsite innovation project in order, in order to sort of prep everybody up for the ideas. We got a whole lot of really good ideas out of it. We had everybody, we were all painting. We had like a little paint shop. We were all doing acrylic painting because we had some folks there that are very structured. And so we said, okay, you're not all structured. So we all were painting. We did some kind of scavenger hunts, and we tried to create more right-brained activities that would kind of unleash the childlike creativity that we all have sort of locked within. It was really quite a fun experience there in Annapolis, and I'm proud to say I wasn't arrested trying to fly my drone there at the state capitol.
I'm happy for that. It makes Saturdays a lot easier when you're actually here.
I know, it really does, but it was quite interesting, and I do believe that education is going to have to reinvent itself if it wants to remain relevant. And so that's what we're working on here at Stratford University. Let's talk a little bit about Open Secure Socket Layer Project. This is, remember this, Secure Socket Layer is that when you go to a website, you've got that little lock box there that when it's locked, it means it's it's encrypted between you and the server. It provides a certain degree of security, like if you do online online payments and that sort of thing. Well, it turned out that the that OpenSSL is an open sourced server which does that secure socket layer encryption. And deep inside of the secure socket layer, there's a part of the code which they call the heartbeat, which is sort of the middle of the encryption engine. And what happened was there was a bug in that whenever they were sending back an answer to you, they would, and the answer was below the minimum packet size, they would just pad the packet up to make it pad it up with just garbage information to kind of make certain it was the proper size. But they were pulling the information that they were padding it with out of the secret cache, which contained all these passwords. So they padded it up with unencrypted stuff, the very stuff that they wanted to protect. So people could just simply communicate with the server, and they could just capture this padding information, and they could uncover all kinds of passwords and everything else. So this was a big problem. But they're just guys volunteering to do it. So last week, the Linux Foundation rounded up vendors. And they got them to all fund this unit, and they got all the vendors together. They're actually funding it, and now they've actually allocated $100,000 for 3 years, to hire two full-time programmers. That's a great thing. You can also go to OpenSSL Project and just do OpenSSL Project donations. You can donate to it if you'd like to donate that. I tell you, this time just went so fast. We love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu and check out the Stratford University programs by going to stratford.edu and tell them you heard about them on Tech Talk Radio.
If you tuned in later or would like to hear the show again, you can listen tomorrow evening at 6 o'clock for a replay of Tech Talk Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio on the air at 1500. 1400 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
O's and Nats on the radio, 12 noon today. Sunny, close to 80 for the high right now inside our studios in Northwest, 70 degrees. It is 10 AM.
This paid